The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. So reliable, it just goes on and on and on.
Hello there, welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, television producer John O'Regan joined me to tell us about what we can expect from the new series of Reeling in the Years, which will be back on our televisions this Sunday evening. Áine Murray, a primary school teacher, psychology graduate and children's author, was on the phone to tell me about her new book, The Pain in the Chest, and she was offering her professional advice on helping children with anxiety. Author Emer Lawler told me about the tragic loss of her daughter and how it led to her writing her debut novel, Dublin's Girl, a story about a farm girl from Cavan who went to live with her aunt and uncle in Dublin so she could attend college. And I spoke with Northern Irish actress Thaddea Graham, who stars in the new Netflix series The Irregulars, about a gang of street urchins who investigate crimes for none other than Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. And we have reached another decade in our favourite programme that hits us in the feels, as young people will say, every time we watch it. It's Series 6, Reeling in the Years 2010 to 19, airing this Sunday, April 11th, RT1, 8:30 p.m. From Katie Taylor to Coda Lyon from Mrs. Brown's Boys to the marriage referendum, fake news is in there, fidget spinners. Wow. Reeling in the Years showcases, of course, the stories and the soundtrack of Ireland over the last 10 years. Wonderful piece of work brought together by a great team led by Mr. John O'Regan. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Ryan.
Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Before we talk about this decade, let me just say that as soon as Donald Trump got elected and then COVID came in again, people always use now Reeling in the Years as an expression to say they'll need one for every week, let alone every year. The yes. pressure to put this decade together must have been intense.
There's a little bit, yes. We'll find out on Sunday when it starts going out, and we'll see what people make to it. But I mean, what we try to do with the program is make pretty much the same type of program that we've made all the way along.
And yes.
You're kind of aiming for that blend of Irish and foreign, and upbeat, downbeat music, slow and fast, and a blend of news and current affairs and music and sport.
Yeah.
So that's what we've tried to do, and we'll find out if people like it or not.
Of course they will.
Very shortly.
But because we could see the ad running over the weekend, and we saw in that short, it must have been, 30 seconds to a minute or whatever, we saw the Anglo-Irish Bank sign, we saw the Queen's visit, Obama's visit with Theresa Mannion's iconic report that time. So let's go consecutively and begin with 2010. And tell us a little bit about what
can
expect.
Start the series in 2010 on Sunday coming. It's the year of the ash cloud, if you remember. There's a volcano in Iceland and it brought travel chaos across Northern Europe. Lots of new things coming into Ireland and abroad. It's the time Google Street View came to Ireland. It's the beginning. It's the launch of the iPad. The Aviva Stadium was opened on Lansdowne Road, and you had the Chilean miners rescue, if you remember that. The 33 miners trapped underground. They were rescued after, 69 days. The huge earthquake in Haiti, and there was a big freeze. It's also the year, I suppose, that the main story of that year is the bailout. It's a rapidly deepening economic crisis. There's a worldwide global crash 2 years earlier. Countries like Greece in a lot of trouble, specifically in Ireland's case. It's a banking and property crash. You've got spiraling debt, you've got fears of international contagion across the Eurozone, and by late 2010, Ireland is effectively starting to run out of time and money. We've got two voices for you to listen to.
I'm getting an ulcer.
Well, it's a short clip. When people talk about nostalgia, I'm not sure how happy people would be on Sunday night to look back at this kind of thing. But Ollie Wren is the first voice you hear. He's the EU Commissioner for Monetary Affairs, and he's followed by Taoiseach Brian Cowan.
It is essential now to stop the final cell bushfire concerning Ireland before it becomes a European-wide forest fire.
I can confirm that the government has today decided that Ireland apply for financial assistance at the European Union.
And so it began.
So it began, 67.5 billion euro was the bailout. The impact of that crash, of course, is right through the series of reeling, is right through the decade.
Yeah.
You've got everything from ghost estates, you've got unemployment at around 15%.
Yeah.
You got immigration returning as a feature of Irish life. You
know? It's funny, just reflecting as you're speaking on that, and it was such, as a news hound, as people are interested in current affairs, that story was moving at such a pace it was hard to keep up. And then, of course, COVID is another level altogether. But we'll keep going then with that. What is 2011?
Well, if we step into 2011, it's full of memorable events. It's a bit like 2016 that you mentioned. It has everything abroad. You've got the Arab Spring, if you remember. It started a street protest in Tunisia, spreads right across so many countries. It becomes open revolution, topples regimes, Libya, Egypt, so many countries across the Arab world. It's 2011 is also the year of the tsunami in Japan, the Fukushima nuclear disaster. In Ireland, you had a general election, huge losses for Fianna Fáil, the Green Party. Fine Gael and Labour coming to power. It's the year of a presidential election and Michael D. Higgins winning the first of his two terms. But in the many, many events of 2011, and certainly as a year as we were editing it, I know that there are many events that we have left out of 2011. Well, there's one week in May, it's particularly memorable, where Ireland's playing host to two visits by international heads of state. You've got Britain's Queen Elizabeth and American President Barack Obama. For the Queen, it's the first visit by a British monarch to the Republic. You've got a few voices to listen to here. The first voice is President McAleese at Dublin Castle at the state banquet for Queen Elizabeth on Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2011.
Okay.
This visit is a culmination of the success of the peace process. It is an acknowledgement that while we, none of us, can change the past, we have chosen to change the future.
Argus Akoiza. With the benefit of historical hindsight, we can all see things which we would wish had been done differently, or not at all.
Remember that whatever hardships the winter may bring, springtime's always just around the corner. And if they keep on arguing with you, just respond with a simple creed. It's fatherling. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
I mean, that is a tale of three different speeches. I remember them. I remember well because I was very fortunate to meet both the players that time, the Queen.
On a Wednesday morning at around 9 o'clock.
God, it was cold and sunny, and I was walking through the city going, God, my granddad saw me now heading to shake the hand of the Queen of England.
Well, the interesting one there is when you hear the Queen saying, Uachtaránachas a Chairde, which, you know, struck an awful lot of people and struck me at the time watching it as it was going out. But then I learned that it's pretty much standard procedure for a British state visit that the Queen always starts a speech in the native language. So she goes to France. The first words are in French.
But she'd never
so we thought
here.
We were special. Yeah. Okay. We're not. However, what you have to say, the reason why it struck so many of us, it's got particular significance and resonance in Ireland because what Britain obviously did to suppress the language across the centuries. So the impact of those words is far greater than it would be in other places. And you also have to think of, you know, symbolic moments like the Queen placing a wreath at the Garden of Remembrance to pay respect to the people who died fighting for Irish freedom.
Yeah.
So there's so many moments across those visits. The Queen was here for 4 days. President Obama was here for about 12 hours.
He was. I was backstage at the Obama speech in College Green, and we all got to meet him, say hello, whatever. Yeah. But as I was passing by, I had to do something on the stage briefly. I saw the auto cue, which is the teleprompter, as they say in America, and for President Obama's speech. And they had phoneticized the Taoiseach as Taoiseach, TEASHOOK. And I said to the guy, because he was very Secret Service, uptight looking fella, I said, look, it's not my business. I said, but if you change shook to shock, you could do yourself a favor. Now, I don't know whether he did or not.
We'll never know. You'll have to ask.
All right. More importantly, obviously, great excitement. The Dubs were on the rampage then.
Yeah, I think one of the big sporting decades is the rise and the dominance in Gaelic football of Dublin. You know, you've got other counties in Gaelic football. You've got Mayo knocking on the door all the time. Donegal winning once. You've always got Kerry. But in fact, if you go back to 2010, it's actually Cork beat Down.
Right.
But where it starts for the Dubs is in 2011. In the All-Ireland final, they're playing Kerry. Dublin have been losing. They fought back to draw level. You go into stoppage time. Dublin get a free kick. Yeah. It's maybe 35 metres about out, 35, 40 yards out. The Dublin goalkeeper, Stephen Cluxton, steps up.
What drama in Croke Park. The distance with the angle, about 45 metres. Here he comes to win the All-Ireland. Cluxton, he's put it over the bar! And Dublin are in front by 112 to 111. Cluxton the hero.
And so it began.
Yeah, Dublin winning 7 out of the 10 All-Irelands across the deck. Of course, it's 6 in a row now. And hurling, of course, you had several different teams winning. You have Kilkenny, Tip, also Clare, Limerick and Galway.
All respectfully given their nod this morning. But it was in the boxing ring in London town. I mean, that was extraordinary.
Yeah, there are many outstanding sporting moments across the decade. This is a terrific moment. These are what you have here, the sounds from the 9th of August 2012. You're in the XL Arena at the London Olympics. You've got Wicklow boxer Katie Taylor fighting in the lightweight final. She's fighting Sofia Uchigava, and the commentary is by the late Jimmy McGee.
Every town and village in Ireland seems to be represented here. And Taylor goes after Uchigava again.
The winner by a score of 10 points to 8 and the Olympic champion.
Beautiful. And let me ask you about the music choices, because ever since I started watching Reeling in the Ears, like everyone else, the majesty of the connection with the music and the footage we're looking at it can't be understated. Where are we going in this decade between the teens?
Well, the teens, I suppose you call them the difficult years, Ron. The target's always with Reeling in the Ears. You'd want to blend that Irish and foreign. You want to blend fast and slow. You always want to foreground the Irish soundtracks, and you always want to bring in as many pop and chart hits as you can. I've picked a couple of tracks here. To give you an inkling of the process, like obviously with COVID, it's quite similar, I suppose, to a lot of people who are like us, who were lucky to have work at this time. But the way we'd work the show is we can't do it the way we used to. So we have two very talented researchers, Owen Cody and Ronan Murphy, and we'd go through lists of footage and we'd work out what we can afford and the licenses for copyright. And, you know, they would compile footage onto computer drives and I'd take it home and I'd end up, I mean, I can give you an example, the one that sticks in my mind, you know, there at kind of midnight or 1 o'clock kitchen table and you've got the computer drives. We're talking about 2012 there and you're blasting through it and you're looking at all the footage and I write everything out in A4 hardback copies. I've got about 15, maybe more of them now. Everything I write out longhand because it helps me to work it all out.
Wow.
So in 2012, if you think of 2012, you've got the opening of the Titanic Centre, Belfast, looking at that footage. Would be good to have a Northern Ireland story because we're always doing the troubles. There's a Costa Concordia sinking, if you remember that big tanker. And then you're looking at the Loyalist flags because Tommy Gorman's got a really good piece there from Belfast City Council. Do you remember the Loyalist flags protest?
Yeah,
and Richard Haas, oh no, that was 2013. And there's a Sinn Féin councillor saying some Loyalists are behaving like it's 2012. But that's a century ago. Would that connect to the Titanic? Don't know. And so I'm looking at Taylor Swift and this is Somebody I Used to Know. Do you remember Somebody I Used to Know?
Taylor Swift.
And then you're thinking, well, Taylor Swift, hang on, We Are Never Getting Back Together. And you've got, oh, look, there's Lance Armstrong admitting to doping. And Ronan's told me Pat McQuaid's Irish guy's in charge. Would that work? And then you look at the Loyalist flag protest. You've got Martin McGuinness shaking hands. You've got, oh, Sean Quinn in the court case.
Oh, my God, my head is melted.
So what's going to work? And you can see it in a few weeks. Nathan Nugent, the editor, has cut it together. You see, and viewers can decide if it works or not. All those things. Mahon Tribunal, Bertie Ahern, you go talk to your friends, talk to my friends, talk to me. But we are never, ever, ever getting back together, like this ever.
Ever.
I can see how attractive that would be as a clip for you. Let's talk about Nathan.
Nathan Carter. Yeah, so just as Reeling features a lot of rock and pop, country music's all very popular. You were mentioning 1981 earlier in the programme, Big Tom and Air 4 Country Roads. I would personally see a connection in terms of that song to something like N17 by Soul Doctors. There's a thread in Irish music about emigration and the way that's reflected in popular music. But, you know, there's also right across the previous Reelings in the Years, you'll see Brendan Shine or Gloria, Daniel O'Donnell. This is probably the biggest country hit of the decade. From Liverpool via Newry, it's Nathan Carter's cover of Wagon Wheel.
So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me.
Yeah, Wagon Wheel, yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I knew about Nathan Carter. That's 2012, by the way. I didn't know before Reeling that it was co-written by Bob Dylan.
Yes.
Actually, yeah. So, I mean, rock me, baby, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Yeah, 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 mama, rock me. Bob Dylan, ladies and gentlemen, Nobel Prize winner for literature. Although, in fairness, I don't think he won it for that. And in fairness to him also, it's an old traditional song that he did.
Yeah, but
I didn't know that
Bob Dylan
and Nathan Carter are there.
They are together in a manner of speaking. In terms of pop music, a new star was born.
Yeah, again, the deliberate choice to showcase Irish music, I don't think it's, I talk about it a lot, but it's not revolutionary. If you're working for a station like RTÉ and you're making a programme like Reeling in the Years, if you're going to sing, you sing an Irish song. So you were talking about 1981, as you were a moment ago. You've got The Police and you've got Talking Heads in there and you've got Queen, but you've also got the Boomtown Rats and you've got Big Tom, you've got Foster and Allen. And this series mixes in Imelda May, The Script, Lisa Hannigan, Codaline Villagers, Gavin James. We're still editing, so I'm not sure, but I'm quite sure. I'm not sure yet, but I would have thought Dermot Kennedy would be in and Soleil. Yeah. The biggest hit, by my reckoning, from an Irish artist, an international hit by an Irish artist in this decade, comes in 2013 when Andrew Hosier Byrne is 23 years old, and the song is Take Me to Church.
Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life.
Brilliant, what a tune. I should forget sometimes how epic that song is until you hear it like that. Okay, let's head to 2014. We're staying in the music world.
In a way, yeah. I mean, we were talking about Dublin GAA a moment ago. They scored that. They got that elusive five in a row in 2019, which becomes six in a row in 2020. But this is another elusive five in a row in Croke Park that never happened. 17 years after a series of legendary performances at Croker, a country superstar announces plans for a comeback special at the same venue. This is where it starts. That star is Garth Brooks.
If you're going to do a comeback special from that and you can pick any place in the world to play, whatever place that is, I think the artist would be given that place the ultimate compliment by picking that. But this is the place to play.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so that's where it started. There's two concerts were announced. They sell out in less than an hour. They add a third and then a fourth and a fifth. However, all those five gigs are sold subject to license to be granted by Dublin City Council. Croke Park's already hosting several pop gigs in 2014. Some residents in the area object. Lengthy negotiations just become a blame game around Ireland's event planning laws. You've got mediation efforts involving the City Council, the promoters, the GAA, Garth Brooks, the Mexican ambassador offers to help get involved. The Obama administration has to make it clear it's not going to get involved. And this is where it ends, on the floor of the Dáil, with the leader of the opposition and the Taoiseach debating the issue.
Wow.
It's not beyond the capacity of the Oireachtas to pass emergency legislation if necessary.
First of all, you'd be accused of doing down the rights of residents who have rights, of course. Secondly, you'd be accused of interfering on top of a planning process.
God, I can tell you this honestly. Anyone in Ireland, anyone on the planet is sad about this. You're not one billionth as sad as I am, because I'm the real loser in this one.
Yeah,
400,000 tickets sold for gigs that never happened.
1 billionth. All right, let's march towards that momentous day, Dublin Castle.
Marriage referendum. There are several referendums across the decade. There are two standout referendums. The most recent is in 2018, the abortion referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment, written into the Constitution since 1983. The earlier one is from 2015, when Ireland became the first country in the world to legalise same-sex marriage by a popular vote. You'll hear two voices here. In a moment, you hear the voice of David Norris addressing the crowd at Dublin Castle. The first voice is Rhiannon Ianala, who's the referendum returning officer, announcing the result.
Votes in favour of the proposal.
1,201,600. From this small independent republic to the entire world is one of dignity and freedom and tolerance, liberty, fraternity, egality.
That's David Norris. It's 4 decades after he had helped found Ireland's first gay rights groups. And there's a line in contemporary Irish history that goes from that 2015 referendum back to civil partnership about 10, 15 years ago, further back into the 90s, the decriminalisation of homosexuality in 93, back to court cases taken by Norris and others in the 80s, with the help of people like Mary Robinson and Mary McAleese before that, who were at the time law professors in Trinity College, the days of the early gay pride marches, the Hirschfeld Centre in Dublin or the Quay Co-op in Cork. And times when gay people were attacked, in some cases murdered simply because they were gay, it leads to that referendum in 2015. Mm. And that was a yes vote by 62% to 38%.
Amazing. It's funny, as every time we get to another point, I in my own selfishness, I remember exactly where I was in a good way. You're just kind of, oh, I remember that time and what it does. And equally with this one, the Brexit referendum, and the expectation being that it'll never happen. It'll be tight, but it'll never happen. My
yeah.
goodness.
Well, Brexit, it's a year, in 2016, it's a year when British Prime Minister David Cameron is deciding to face down the critics in his own and other parties once and for all. Remember, Cameron had won a referendum about Scottish independence in 2014. Mm. He'd also won a general election in 2015. He defied the opinion polls and they won a Tory majority. There are four voices to listen to here. At the end of it, you hear Theresa May, who replaced Cameron. Before that, you hear Nigel Farage, who you know. You hear the voice of Jenny Watson, a returning officer, and this clip starts with David Cameron announcing the in-out referendum.
I will go to Parliament and propose that the British people decide our future in Europe through an in-out referendum.
This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! Let June the 23rd go down in our history as our Independence Day!
Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
Well, that's
well, Brexit,
for history
yeah.
to decide.
Brexit, I suppose we'll continue to live out whatever Brexit means. I suppose right now it means vaccines, maybe you could say. But
indeed.
I was thinking of Tommy Gorman, who I mentioned earlier, who retired the other week, and he was talking about the current state of Anglo-Irish relations. When you look back now to 2011 and the visit of Queen Elizabeth, and 2014, the visit of Michael D. Higgins as president
yes.
to the UK, you now look back and you can see that that was a high point and we're not at a high point now.
That's for sure. OK. The fragility of that situation borne out over the weekend indeed. That's what's so interesting about this programme, because it's history on the hoof in some ways, because it's so recently minted history. It still feels like journalism, still feels like current affairs. It's that intriguing nowhere land between history and politics, in a manner of speaking, which brings us beautifully to 2016. Where we're staying after Brexit, just when we thought the world couldn't get much weirder.
Yeah, in 2016, there are many memorable events. People remember the Rio Olympics. You remember, Pull Like a Dog, the O'Donovan brothers and Annalise Murphy winning silver. Euro soccer in France. You got the centenary commemorations of the 1916 Rising. You also have an election in the States. You've got a billionaire businessman, TV celebrity. He's a rank outsider to get the nomination. His name is Donald Trump. He gets the nomination. His opponent is an established career politician, Secretary of State. She's been senator. She's got high profile from being First Lady. He is Donald Trump. She is Hillary Clinton. And the editor, Colm O'Brien, and I were looking at these moments only recently, because we're still in production. We are still editing this programme. It's not finished yet.
Wow. Right?
But we remember the election of Trump. What you don't remember is how unpleasant and divisive that campaign was. Mm. And Colm and I pulled a couple of clips from the candidates' debates for you to listen to.
Believe me, she has tremendous hate in her heart.
This is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs.
If I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah. Because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
Yep. It is incredible. Okay, that takes us to 2016, and the rest of it is in production.
The rest of it is okay. I think we all know how it finished, right? We just have to craft it together, Colm O'Brien and Ronan and Owen Murphy and Claire McQuaid and I.
And well done to together. One and all. I have to say hats off to you and the team. You know, because this decade that you're talking about ends, obviously, at the tail end of 2019. And that's when, once again, everything changed.
Yeah, I mean, the question that you asked earlier is how you would fit 2020 into a year. You know, in some ways, I think at an emotional level, 2020 isn't finished yet. It doesn't really finish until enough people get vaccinated and we can move on from it.
Yes.
But certainly operationally, just in terms of the focus of it, let's just get, we have to get reeling to 2019 first. But the first thing I think about 2020 in terms of a reeling in the year is it's going to be 25 minutes long. And in the end, it's a compilation of other people's programmes. And it only reeling only exists because day-to-day people are making television and news and entertainment and sport. And if you think about 2020, you think of your own Late Late Toy Show and all the late, late moments, but you think of RT Investigates and One Day in May, that documentary, the fantastic documentary, the comic relief. You've got all the news back to the election results in February 2020. And I'm not bigging up RT here as a general point. Other stations like Virgin and News Talk are doing what they do, and other media like newspapers are being produced remotely. But the point I'd make, you look at companies like Element Pictures, Normal People, 2020 for the BBC, going on Hulu in the States. That's world-class television produced in Ireland. Whenever anybody does look back on 2020, there's a lot to look at through the medium of television and for a programme like Reeling. And Reeling only exists because day to day people make the day to day output and leave those moments for people to look back on.
John O'Regan, you're truly excellent at what you do. Thank you for all the Reelings so far. And here's to the next season starting on Sunday night, the 11th of April at 8:30. We will be glued. Go well and thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was only telling you last week about the principal, school principal I met on one of my walks, lovely man, and we were chatting about, I was saying, how are you getting on with the return post-Easter of all the children? And he was saying to me that the academic side of things were easy enough to confront and deal with, but the emotional and mental health side of things were where the real trouble lay for teachers and principals and parents alike. And somebody sent in a text saying, you know, you need to read The Pain in the Chest. It's a beautiful little book by Áine Murray, who's a psychology graduate and a teacher. And I got a copy of the book and it was as beautiful as I expected, and actually better. It's gorgeous illustration and beautifully put together by Áine Murray, who joins us now. Good morning, Áine.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Hey, congratulations on your book. It's really gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
You should be. If this was the toy show, I would be putting it in, on my list of Irish books to show, to flash up. Because I'll tell you what it is. The name itself is, I don't know if it's an Irish thing, but it is universally understood for children and adults, weirdly. But let's talk about children. Talk to me, Áine, about The Pain in the Chest.
Yeah, so the book follows a little girl who, she has a lot of big worries, and it kind of shows us scenarios where she wants to do something and is stopped by all these overwhelming, like, what ifs. So she wants to get a balloon, for example, and she thinks, but what if I get it and it hurts my hand? Or what if I get it and I lose my mum? And all of these worries kind of manifest as a pain in her chest. And she's also followed around by this little worry monster who you kind of spot throughout the pages. And you see her kind of when she's seven, she doesn't want to audition for a play because of all her worries. And then she's in secondary school. She doesn't want to make friends because she's too afraid that, you know, people won't like her or they'll think she's weird. And eventually it comes to a point where she wants to have a party and she tells her mum. And her mum's kind of confused because she never knew. She kind of thought she was shy or, you know, never liked balloons or never wanted to be on stage. And the girl finally shares that she does like those things but has always been stopped by a pain in her chest. And when she finally shares it with her mum is able to empathise and validate her feelings and explain that it happens to her too, and explains that when we talk about our feelings, it will make us feel better. And that's the message that kind of the book sends, that we should talk about our feelings.
Right. And I love the examples you pick. You could tell you're a teacher because you obviously know that, you know, some children would be afraid to lose the balloon from the helium goes to the sky. What do you do next? But also they want to be on stage like all the other girls and boys, the popular ones, if you like, but they don't want to be seen to be different, or they don't want to separate themselves from the crowd. Similarly, making friends. And then I think even she's 18 in the book at the end where she says, I want a party because everyone has parties, but I don't want to be the centre of attention. You know, it's a very difficult sea to navigate.
Exactly, yeah. And
for all comers, parents, teachers, and the poor child, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And she, I suppose, never had the language for it, and the mum then gives her that language and explains that it's very normal to have these feelings. You know, we all have them. And if we talk about it, we can do the things we want to do, and we don't have to let the pain in the chest stop us from doing those things.
I keep quoting Shrek every time, better out than in, Fiona, you know.
Yeah.
But it's so true. He was talking about different things, but ultimately there's truth in it. Now, you worked with Childline for a little while, didn't you?
I did, yeah, I did.
Can you tell me a little bit about what pains in the chest, and in a manner of speaking, you heard about at the other end of the phone?
I suppose at Childline, we would have heard a lot of, they wouldn't be there to tell us about their worries. They'd be there just to have a chat with us. And it was kind of a place where children could talk to someone and tell us about their day, and had someone there to listen in a very kind of non-judgmental, non-directive way. They could tell us whatever they needed to tell us without being told what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very helpful to bring into a classroom as well as a teacher, because, you know, children, it helps me centre any issues that children have around, like, thoughts and feelings. That was very adamant in Childline, that everything was around thoughts and feelings, because while context can change, and context is important, but context can change, like, people's perspectives on situations can change. Thoughts and feelings are very real, and for children.
So you would be the independent ear guiding them to, well, encouraging them to talk, because that can often be a hard thing to do if somebody does have the pain in the chest, a child particularly, is you can't coax the problem out of them. Did you ever have a thought about that in terms of how do parents get to the place where the child feels comfortable explaining what's wrong?
Yeah, I think just assuring children that they can talk, that that you're always there, and they're not making sure you're not forcing them or like trying to coaxing it out of them, but just assuring them that you will be there to listen. And, you know, things that I've done for children that I feel that are upset, even things like getting them to, you could get them to draw a picture if they're not comfortable to talk, or if there's something like a song that they feel represents their feelings, maybe you could show us the song, and just letting them know that they can tell us in a way that suits them, but without forcing them, you know.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Anya, was the return to school. And I think that adults will have a version of it when it comes back to returning to the workplace. But let's talk about kids going back to school, particularly for the bunch of kids who haven't been for ages and ages. At least some have gone back, but after Easter there's a whole bunch of school going, not children, but there's young adults, some of them, who are going back. It's not easy, and you know, we shouldn't assume that they're going back, they're all going to be delighted. I mean, it's almost re-socialising again.
Yeah, it is. I mean, for a lot of kids it was amazing to be back, and they did really miss that connection and sense of belonging. But for a lot of other kids, they were quite comfortable at home, and coming back was scary for them, and having to do group work and comparing themselves to other children. But it's even more important that those children are back, because you can't go on life without socialising with your peers, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do also think that, like, I know you say, you know, academics isn't a big worry, but I do think a lot of children feel like they're expected to do, like, this. So I teach fourth class, and
yes,
I think they're expected to be at a fourth class standard. And a lot of language is going around at the minute that the children are, like, falling behind in their academic skills, as well as their social skills, I suppose. But I do think that can be very damaging, because the idea that they're falling behind, like, falling behind who, you know? Like, it's them against them, and, you know, it's very important to assure them that if they can't do something, that is nothing to do with them. That is just, you know, your teacher figuring out where you're at, or looking at what we need to go over again. But you're not falling behind. You're at where you're at, and we'll try to get you further, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
can be worrying for children.
Exactly. And pressure can be felt in a house from the top down. So parents should equally just be aware that don't be killing yourself with pressure and worry about the schoolwork and the academic side of things. It'll all fall into place in due course. It is a pandemic. It's every 100 years. Everyone take a breath. You know, and nothing is as it should be. And that goes for so many different walks of life at the moment. One last thing I want to ask you about, Áine, is regression. And I know a lot of families are dealing with children, you know, some whose SNAs are out of the picture at the moment and what have you. And they've just taken two steps back, which is heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I suppose it is, it's, again, like, you just have to say, take them as they are. Don't feel like it's, you know, take it step by step and day by day. And, you know, it's always, as teachers, you know, you're looking at the child and you're starting with the child. You're not starting with what you think they should be at. Just start with right now and work from there. But yeah, I understand. Like it is very difficult.
So you're teaching fourth class.
Yes.
What school are you teaching in?
Ashburn Educate Together National School.
And you're off for the Easter holidays at the moment.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to getting back.
I bet you are. You're not. You don't attend the teachers' conferences yourself, do you? Or you don't get involved with?
No.
No interest in that. And are you vaccine-wise, are you happy enough with that situation, the way it's going, or are you concerned?
With which?
The vaccine teachers getting vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, I can't... I'm not going to complain. I'm healthy, I'm young, and someone has to get the vaccine. So, look, I'm happy with whatever is decided.
With what Neffet have said, and
yeah,
by them, the government, of course. I hope you have more books to come. Have you, Áine?
Yeah, that's the plan. Mental health is something I'm interested in. So, you know, anxiety is this one, but we're hoping to in the future look into different aspects of mental health for kids.
Is there an age market, if forgive the word, but is there an age group that your book is aimed at? Because it could...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think picture books are for everyone. And I think as a teacher, you know that picture books are for every primary school age.
Sure.
And can be used differently for different ages. So I suppose younger children, I have found, have loved the little furry worry monster in the stories. And I just want to say thanks to Brona Lee, the illustrator. I can't leave without mentioning her. She's just been amazing. And she made up.
She did a gorgeous job on the illustrations. I have to say, they really compliment your text. And I got kind of Charlie and Lola vibes off the book, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, very
charming.
Her artwork is amazing. Her Instagram handle is Bunty Lee. So if anyone's interested in looking at more.
I'll definitely check it out. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
Sorry. So yeah, the younger children have loved that. And they do recognise, you know, that, you know, I have a pain in my tummy, this girl has a pain in her chest, I sometimes get a pain in my head. So they catch on to that and understand, they take away the message to talk about your feelings. And then on the other hand, older children take all that, but also are able to reflect on, you know, their own situation and apply it to their own lives. So it's great to use as a prompt for those older children as well. So I do think the book is for all primary school ages.
I definitely agree with you. Owen, it's been good to talk to you. Congratulations on The Pain in the Chest and thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Not at all. Thanks, Áine. And if you want to get your hands on that book, head to thebookmark.ie. That's a very easy address to remember, thebookmark.ie. And if you have a child in your life, in your world, or if you're a big child yourself, and you have a pain in your chest, it's a very sweet, kind, thoughtful, beautifully illustrated book. And I don't say that lightly. And that's by Áine Murray with the Father on the A. What do we got for you? 12 minutes to 10. And let me say good morning to Eimear Doyle. Good morning, Eimear.
Morning, Brian.
It's nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
We spoke before.
We did, yes.
And we spoke about something very serious and very sad. And what I'm going to say to you is, we'll address that in a few minutes' time. How about that?
That's fine. It's perfect. Yeah.
Is that okay with you? Because you've achieved something that is not unrelated to where we'll go later on, because it's something that I think is very important to you. It's close to your heart. It's close to your soul. It's close to your brain. and that is you've written a book, a fiction book, and it's out there. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Tell us what it is and what it's about.
It is kind of based on my great aunt who was working in Dublin in 1918 for Sinn Féin, and she worked through the 1918 elections and then in the subsequent War of Independence.
Yeah.
And it's, I just got the idea, I read her witness statement from that everybody gave to the government to be involved in the, I suppose, the politics of that time.
Yes.
And it was, I just found it very fascinating. She went to Dublin when she was 17 and worked in Sinn Féin and Hard Court, involved in the elections. And in the statement, it says how the officers were attacked by the Trinity students. She worked for Father of Flanagan as well. And I just got the idea from that because I was on a creative writing course and I wrote a short story. And from that, I thought this would make a great book.
Yeah.
And I changed her name then to Veronica McDermott.
Sorry? Go ahead.
Yeah, and then that's when the story flowed because I didn't feel comfortable using writing about my great aunt because, as far as I know, she didn't marry and didn't have a relationship. And she was a real person.
Yes.
So I didn't know how she reacted because she was working with Michael Collins and even De Valera. So I couldn't create how she acted every day. So I just created a new character and story flowed from there.
Okay, so your great aunt was an intriguing figure, really, if we could talk about her for a moment. And I have a copy of her witness statement from the Bureau of Military History, which is a treasure trove of stories. And as it says itself, it's an eyewitness statement. And it's really looking at history on the move as it happened at the time. I mean, that must have been a delight for you to read.
Yeah, my cousin Jim was doing the family history.
Yeah.
And I had been doing a bit of writing at the time when he started. And he sent it down to me. And I knew my great-aunt had been involved in the politics at the time because my father had told me about his aunt Vera, who worked for Amy De Valera. And his father was also involved in the volunteers. But I didn't actually know to this extent because I think these were kept open to, I think they're only closed to the public in 2002.
Yes.
So I didn't know the full extent. We just knew that she'd been involved. And so it was fascinating.
Fascinating.
I saw she was only 17 and she had did so much in her life from the age of 17. And it was a very courageous time because it must have been quite scary as well.
Of course. And you know, to be beside Michael Collins one minute and Dev the next. And did she was taking kind of note-taking and meetings between pro-treaty and anti-treaty sides? I mean, she was a witness to the creation of the state and of Irish freedom.
Yeah, she was anti-treaty then at the end.
Mm.
And just at the very end of the statement, of which I haven't included anything in the book, was fascinating that she hand-delivered a letter to the Free State.
Yes.
Because the Free State were demanding everybody hand up their arms in February 1923. And she gave a letter to the Free State that they were refusing to hand up their arms. And she was arrested and she was going to be brought to Cunningham Jail. And there was a letter sent from the Geneva Convention to say it was illegal to retain a courier. So she was released.
Right.
And at the time I was thinking, was she going to be shot? Because they said she was bringing her to Cunningham Jail and keep her interned, but she was released at 5 o'clock that day.
You know what what I love about your grandaunt's story, and my own grandmother was in Cumann na Mban as well, is that I think with stories like yours, I mean, yours is your fictional story, Dublin's Girl, is loosely based on your grandaunt, but we are starting to bring these women back from the shadows, out of the shadows, and into the forefront where they belong. It's been too long.
Yeah, I always find it amazing that after the War of Independence, the women sort of, were shoved back into the shadows.
Correct. Yeah,
they were quite active during the War of Independence.
Well, that's what happened, isn't it? We were talking about that not too long ago, about how that, you know, shortly after the kind of independence, the fellas took over and said, right, there's the kitchen, we'll leave you to it, and we'll head up and get the constitution sorted out.
Yeah, I think the government, there's Conor McGale that was in, and women, and then they brought in the marriage bar, and I think women just lost all the rights.
Yeah, difficult. You'd love to have come back and said, no. you're making a terrible mistake. Anyway, you got it. You wrote the novel Dublin's Girl, but as you say, Vera becomes, in a manner of speaking, Veronica. And where do we go with that? Tell us about it.
This Veronica story.
Yeah.
She went to Dublin when she was 17 as an statement. She went to work for Sinn Féin, and while she was in it was called the Leinster School of Typing for Girls. And Father O'Flanagan was the vice president of Sinn Féin at the time, and she went asked for her. My grandfather was involved in politics, so I can only assumed that they would have known each other because Father Flanagan was involved in Cavan as well.
Okay.
So he asked her to leave the school before she actually finished the year to go to work for him as a typist in Pembroke Road. And then she, Veronica, moved up to the Sinn Féin offices to work for them full time. So it was a fun story. I was just got on living with her aunt and uncle, were totally fixed. And she got involved in, I suppose, espionage, delivering notes and letters, and she bumped into this English soldier, and then she got involved with him. I didn't intend her to meet an English soldier.
Yeah.
When I started writing this, I had no intention of writing any love interest in it at all. And just as I was writing, Harry appeared on the page.
Came from above.
It came from my pen.
Yes.
Any time I write anything, I always start one way, and then it takes a different direction. So I just thought, he's nice. He's a nice man.
Of course. So you might as well bring him to join the party. Tell me why, Emer, this book was so important for you.
Well, I actually didn't start writing till 2014. I'd always liked the idea of writing, but never did any. I was an avid reader, and I read everything. From the first Lady Bird book to Stephen King, absolutely everything. And I just thought I didn't have an imagination.
Okay.
And Kira said to me in 2014, Richard said to me, Mom, do something with your life other than sitting around town and drinking coffee with your friends.
Yeah.
So I'd been a stay-at-home mum. And I had seen NUI Maynooth doing a creative writing course in Kilkenny, which I had spotted the year before. I thought, no, I wouldn't be able to do that because I can't write creatively. I have no imagination. So when Kira said this to me, I said, right, I'm going to do this. So I enrolled in that. Mm-hmm. And on it went. Yeah, it did. Yeah, there was a short story, and then it evolved. And after the course, when Kira passed away, I had written the book at that stage. It just needed heavy editing. And so I stopped writing for a year or two after Kira passed away.
And it was writing that brought us together, that we met the first time.
Because
you wrote that beautiful letter.
It was. And it was when I was going to grief counselling. Mm-hmm. The grief counsellor asked me, what do I do? What do I like to do? And I said, well, I used to do writing. And she asked me to write a few stories. And I said, no, I couldn't. So I just started writing down my grief. Very, very early on, I'd say some about August 2016, any bit of paper. So then eventually that evolved into a diary called Dear Kira Diary. Mm-hmm. And then I had heard about your letter of regret. Even though I had been, I was still devastated, I wasn't really listening to radio every day because you're still immersed in grief and you're thinking about. So I just said, it was very easy to write because in my diary I write, Dear Kira, and I said, do you remember we did this? Do you remember we did that with your brothers? And I would tell them what they're doing daily. So I wrote the letter and I sent it off to you, and I didn't expect you to read it because I actually went swimming on Friday morning, because I normally go swimming. And after I came out of the pool, there was all these text messages and voicemail messages.
There's an excerpt of your letter I want to share with people, just remind people. And it's your letter to Kira. And we should say, how old was Kira when she died, Emer?
17,
which she had an underlying heart condition. She was at a Codaline concert, isn't that right?
Yeah, she was Codaline, yeah.
And part of your letter that struck us as being so beautiful was you said, Do you remember what your friends in secondary school used to say when they shared a secret with you? They always finished their sentence stories saying, "And Kira, don't tell your mother." But you did, because you told me all your friends' secrets. And do you remember when you put eyeshadow on me and said that you loved putting eyeshadow on my wrinkly eyelids? And do you remember you left me for the Codaline concert on the Friday afternoon in July 2016? You were so happy with all your friends. And I wished I hugged you before that, but before you left. That's my only regret. Family, neighbours and friends silently lined the street as you were brought back home to Kilkenny on a Monday evening. On a Wednesday morning in July, we said goodbye, but you will always be forever my angel and always in our hearts and minds. Lots of love and hugs from Mammy. Was that torture for you to write? Or was it liberating?
No, it was probably was very upsetting. Mm. But it was, I wanted to write it. It wasn't something I didn't want to write. I didn't put down. I wrote very quickly. I started to write it in the afternoon. I wasn't going to send it. And I just wrote it down. And it was just something, I suppose it was kind of liberating and it was just very nice. My way of being close to Kira, it's my connection. Because over time, your grief dulls. The ache is always there, but it's not as severe. But this is my connection. And my private, and even though it was not very private when you send it into the national radio station, but my diary is my private, and I do write in this, and it's my private time with Kira. And I would look forward to writing into it.
When you have your private time with Kira, do you believe you're communing with her? Do you believe she's somewhere?
I do now, in a funny, yes, because this is so many things happen. That it's far too much of a coincidence.
Like what?
Even the first one wasn't Codaline, it was a song for Kira and they called it Angel. And Mark came to Kilkenny and came to meet us and he gave us a CD. And we actually have a picture in our hallway, a sketch of Kira when she was about 8, and there's a picture of an angel on the T-shirt.
Right.
And we just thought, oh, that's fascinating. Not fascinating, but that was amazing. And just little things always pop up. You might think something.
Yes.
And then, actually, lots of the times the Codaline song comes on the radio. And
yeah.
It's very bizarre. But that's even my connection. That's a very comforting connection as well, their music.
It's like, you remind me as you're talking of Shane Filan of Westlife fame, talking on The Late Late Show recently, who lost both his parents, and how robins, the little birds, he's convinced it's them, saying, "You're going to be having a good day today," or "I'm watching you," you know?
Oh, yeah, we have robins everywhere now.
Do you? And do you see, I mean, do you think with it, when you see the robins, do you think of Kira, do you think?
Yes, of course I do, yeah. Mm. I have a good picture in my kitchen as well, and a friend of mine gave it to me, and it says, "When robins are near, angels appear."
Mm.
And it's comforting as well.
And the book, I mean, Kira was kind of, as you said, she was the one saying to you, "Come on, do something else." Right. And I wrote it down here. You said twice to me in our chats that you feared you had no imagination. Why did you think that, I wonder?
And it's really bizarre.
Were you told it?
No. If you asked me to tell you a story now,
yeah.
I couldn't think of anything. But if I had to write it down, I'd say by the end of the sentence, I know what something happens. But it's just like when I put pen to paper, it's a completely different experience. So when I think of something, I write it down, I put it, even when I go to type it on the computer, it's nearly changed. By the third time, but I wouldn't have a great imagination. I wouldn't be able to, I'd say, be an oral storyteller.
Yeah.
But when I write, it's completely. And even I'm writing a book at the moment, and kind of a 3-book deal in Second World War in Ireland. And I give a small outline. I keep creating new characters as I'm going along. Every day I write a little bit every morning.
I love that though. This is something that has been one of my COVID revelations. Is how introverts are thriving because it's like their time because they're finding it easier in some ways, not all of them obviously, but most of them, and not that you're an introvert necessarily, Eimear, but just in terms of having this time to write, not having to be in the coffee shop or in the pub or whatever, holding court or being part of a group. You're happy, I presume, writing away.
Well, once I got over the first lockdown, I think anxiety of looking at Twitter every 2 minutes. And now, for me, what I find it is brilliant. I'm doing all the Zoom meetings, and I'm talking to the publishers in England, and we're having a book launch tonight on Facebook, and I can do it from Kilkenny. I don't have to go to the UK because the book is in all the bookshops in England as well.
Yes.
And so I don't have to fly to the UK. I can do it from my the office, and I just find I have more time during the day to do things. I don't have to start preparing notes and spending 2 or 3 days.
I can just be
so productive.
And how are you broadly speaking, Emer? Are you okay otherwise?
Yes, fine. It's all very calm.
Calm, all is calm.
Calm, Kilkenny.
That's what we need to hear. Congratulations on the book. I'm sure there's bittersweet feelings, but I can feel and sense that Ciara was part very much of this story, and I'm happy for you. Well done.
Thank you.
And the best of luck.
Yeah, my agent actually said that to me at one point during the summer. I said something to her, and she said she felt that she was only a bystander.
Okay.
And that it was a journey of me and Ciara.
Lovely. Well put and well said. That's really nice. And there's lovely comments coming in to support you this morning as well, Emer. Mind yourself and thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing you hopefully in Kilkenny sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
All the best. This Emer Doyle is the author of Dublin's Girl. This is her debut novel, first of three in a three-book deal published by Head of Zeus. There's quite the name. And you can get that in Easons.com or local bookshops, and dealing with a very interesting time in Irish history, no doubt about that. And I'll get to some of those texts in a moment. Isn't it funny, the discussion on whether or not we should play Simply Red, which I'm not going to play today. I'm not anti-Simply Red. There's one or two songs I like of theirs. What was the comment somebody said? They got to a certain age and they saw Mick Hucknall and couldn't quite understand how did he have all these gorgeous women around him. And I said, well, that's a very judgmental thing. Anyway, Simply Red, that's for another day. I want to talk about The Irregulars. And the reason I want to talk about The Irregulars is because it's connected to one of my favourites, which is, of course, Sherlock Holmes. It's a new TV show. It's set in Victorian London. It centres around, it's the gang, it's the street urchins who Holmes and Watson use as their eyes and ears on the streets of Victorian London. And this show is doing quite the job at the moment. And one of its stars is Thaddea Graham, who's on the line now. Thaddea, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Congratulations on top billing on this top show on Netflix. You're brilliant in it.
Oh, thank you very much. It's too kind.
Are you excited by all the action in it and the attention from it?
Oh, it's been very, very surreal. But it's been really lovely to finally be able to share it, because we worked on that job for over a year.
Yeah.
And obviously when you're shooting it, you can't say anything, and it's all very secret and hush-hush. And then a couple of months later, half a year later, the world's talking about it.
The world's
talking
about it.
Very, very strange. Very overwhelming.
Did you make this? One of the key things, especially in the UK, is did you make the poster on the tube station?
We did.
Yes!
We made Baker Street Station.
Oh, even better.
Taken over for the launch weekend. And our faces are splashed across it. So God love everyone going past those every day.
So give us a rundown on the show itself. You mentioned Baker Street, of course. I mentioned Sherlock Holmes. But there's also another twist in the tale here as well. Thaddea, tell us, what are we talking about with the Invincibles? The Irregulars,
so, like
sorry.
You said, we are set in the very familiar Sherlock Holmes universe, but we see the world through the Baker Street Irregulars. And my character, B, is the leader of this little gang, and we end up working with Dr. Watson, who is this very mysterious, elusive man who says, I run a small detective agency and I need you to work for me. And in return, I'll give you money. And so he needs us to access the parts of London that he can't get to as a very kind of prim and proper man.
Yes.
So we get sent off on those kind of investigations. And as we kind of burrow further into them, we realise there's something larger at play, and supernatural things start happening, and it gets very scary very quickly.
Yeah, sure does.
And the deeper we go, the closer to home it hits, and we start to realise, hang on, this is a bit too connected to my life, and they kind of discover why that is.
Now, listening to you talking, you've got to give us some details about yourself. Can I ask you the rude question of how old you are?
I've just turned 24.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And where in the world are you from? Obviously, you're from Ireland.
Yes, I'm from up north. I'm from County Down, but I'm currently in Dublin.
Oh, well, welcome home.
Thank you very much.
What part of County Down?
I'm from like near the Mourne Mountains, so out in the countryside and beautiful, beautiful surroundings.
Oh, gorgeous. The Mountains of Mourne, of course. Gorgeous. Now,
Yeah. Did
you have any interest at all growing up in detectives and crime and all of these things?
I used to love playing cops and robbers in the garden with my neighbours, but we were kind of running around trees arresting frogs and stuff, so it's not really the same. But
yes.
I think, you know, the cases are still of the same weight.
And you survived the pandemic shooting obviously the irregulars because presume production was in full flight, stop, go. Was that unnerving or was it something that you just had to roll with, Teddy?
Yeah, so we were 2 weeks away from wrap. We were so close to wrap. And they said, right, we're going to shut down and it's just a precautionary thing, so don't worry, we'll see you soon. And then 4 or 5 months later, I was sat at home in Northern Ireland thinking, has everyone else gone back to shoot this? And they just haven't called me. But then we went back with these new protocols and it was definitely a bit nerve-wracking. But I suppose it's the fear of the unknown. Yeah. Nobody really knew how to work in these circumstances, but we had a brilliant COVID team who kept us all safe and we were being tested all the time. And I think something that really benefited us was that we had spent so long together before this happened. So it wasn't so scary going into a workspace where everyone's got, you can only see their eyes.
Of course.
Because I knew who everyone was. And we all did it together. And I think it was really nice to just voice those fears with people and share that kind of experience. And go, oh, do you feel a bit nervous? Yeah, I feel a bit nervous too. So I think we were very, very lucky.
Let me ask you, if I may, about your background, because tell us where you were born and the circumstances, if you don't mind, about...
No, it's grand.
Yeah, because your story fascinated me when I was reading about it. You were born where and when?
I was born in China in 1997. And when I was 13 months old, I was adopted to Northern Ireland. And that's where I've grown up ever since. And yeah.
So you were.
So if you saw me in real life, my face wouldn't really match my accent.
No. And of course, I saw you. When I say real life, I watched it in the regulars, obviously. But when I read about this backstory, I was, as I say, fascinated. You had been left at the entrance of a building in China when you were 3 days old.
Yeah, a couple of days old.
Yeah.
And then I was found by someone who was just walking along, and they took me to the police station, and then they sent me on to the orphanage. So even my birthday is a guess, but a very educated guess, but a guess nonetheless.
And how old were you when you were adopted by your parents in Northern Ireland?
13 months old.
And was it a big deal in the sense that your first on-screen appearance involved a high chair and scrambled eggs? So,
one of my earliest memories is sitting in the kitchen looking at a camera crew eating like toasty soldiers and scrambled eggs because I think they'd done some spotlight program or something because I was one of the first. I think I was one of the first international adoptions from China to Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So it was a big news story at the time, but it's just funny that I'm now kind of in that environment again in a different way.
For sure.
It's meant to be, I suppose.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And your folks and their relationship with you and then with China, were they very keen to make it all a very inclusive part of your story as a family?
Oh, yeah, I just have to look in the mirror and realise that I don't look like my parents. So that was never a secret. And they were so open about it. And when I was little, they would talk all the time about my family in China. They were very, you know, keen to make me aware of that and very respectful of that. And they took me back to China a couple of times on holiday just so that I could see where I was from and experience the culture. And I think that was an incredible thing for them to have done. And we've always spoken really openly about the adoption and about my past, which I think is a brilliant way to have done it. And I'm so lucky to have them. They're just wonderful people.
You struck gold and they struck gold. Everyone won.
Yeah, I definitely did.
You hate the word abandoned.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, I think I can't speak for everyone's situation because they're all different, but in my situation, I don't feel like I was abandoned at all. I feel like I was left in a place where my biological parents knew that I was going to be fine. And I like to think, I think whatever situation you're in, you have a choice to look at it positively or negatively. And there's enough negativity in the world already. You know, give the positive one a chance and see what happens. And I like to think that they left me in the hopes that I would be fine and that I see it as a second chance at life.
Mm.
And I don't want to waste that. I don't think that the decision to leave your child is an easy one at all. So I want to honour that decision that they made and the chance that my parents in Northern Ireland took and all the opportunities they've given me and really make the most of it all and see what happens.
Gosh, you've a beautiful attitude, if you don't mind me saying so. No, I love it. It's a gorgeous philosophy and it's a very kind one too. And I'd say it gives you great peace of mind.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with all the stuff, you know, that's happening with the regulars. It can be a little bit overwhelming, but I would not be here today without the kindness of strangers. And if I can, you know, people have constantly given me opportunities and taken chances on me. Not just like through school and stuff like that as well. And then obviously going to drama school and my agent and things like that, they all took chances and really supported me. And if I can give even like 1% of that back into the world, then that's all I want to do.
Do you believe that you should, not that you should, but do you think it's ingrained in you, in your heart and your soul, that you should be more aware or just be aware of carrying that forward? You know, like that thing where you pay it forward, you say, buy the next person behind me a cup of coffee. Do you feel that attitude almost in your life? You say you feel that you got supported by the kindness of strangers and therefore you could have a role in letting that domino continue to fall.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think that's just... Well, I think it has a large part to do with my own personal story,
yeah.
But I think people in general, like, it costs nothing at all to be kind. And if we can all just be a little bit more gentle and patient, not only with other people, but with ourselves as well, then that's not a bad thing at all, is it?
Wise words. And, you know, I'm just looking at your date of birth, as you say, 1997. So you're a child of the peace process and would have grown up in a beautifully peaceful Northern Ireland. And the last three nights, I'm looking at petrol bombs and burnt out cars. And I'm just so sad and slightly depressed by the sight going, I thought and prayed and hoped that those sights on the TV that I grew up with every day when I was your age and younger were gone. When you look at that on the news at night, what do you think?
It's really sad to see. It's really disheartening and a little bit scary as well. And to see so many young people involved.
Because they're your age.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people that I know from home, my experience has been that, you know, everyone kind of leaves. Everyone's left Northern Ireland and gone to uni, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And the people with these kind of different views are the ones who've left and are not there to kind of talk to other people. And
yes.
I don't actually know how we fix it, but I really hope we get to a place of more peace and kind of... you know, sit down and have a conversation and really talk to people and understand why they are the way they are.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the way forward. Conversations and patience.
Patience. You're so right. Funny, I was only saying it earlier on in the week about how people would be much better off stopping and saying to somebody, I don't really agree with you. I'd love to talk about it rather than effing and blinding them out of it. And equally throwing a petrol bomb, whatever. Let me go back to the irregulars for a moment, if you don't mind, Thaddea, because you're of Chinese heritage, and now you're an irregular in Victorian London.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm thinking Bridgerton now have been doing this. Hamilton, of course, has been doing it on stage. We are colorblind and culture blind. All we want to see is talented people. Our talented people on stage and screen. Can you talk to me about that and where you're at with it all?
Yeah, so I remember getting the audition script in for a regular, and I kind of looking at my agent like, have you forgotten what I look like? This says Victorian London, this won't work. But the only person who ever had a problem with that was me.
Yeah.
I was the only one doubting myself. I was the only one trying to talk myself out of it before I even got into the room to read or meet them.
Mm.
And my experience so far, I think, has been I've been very lucky and very fortunate, but I hope that I'm not the anomaly. I hope that this is the way that things are going, and that Sarah Crowe, our casting director, is incredible. She brings so many different people in from all over the place and different walks of life to read for these characters, and she's really interested in just finding the right people for the right job. And I think that's the way forward. And I do think that we need to... I think we need to let people with authentic voices tell their own stories, whatever that is.
Yes.
I think we need more of that. And we need to be, I suppose, patient, because, you know, we see so many of the same kind of movies and TV shows being made over and over and over again. And even if they're, like, a 3 out of 10, they still get another run at it. And I think we need that same kind of lenience with stories that we're not so kind of familiar with.
Yes.
So, for example, if there's a... if we have an LGBTQ plus storyline in a movie, we need the scope to have an okay one. They don't all have to be phenomenal, because there's this expectation of, if you, unless it's great, we're not going to make another one. And that's not fair, because, you know, all of these other stories are made 100 times over and they're mediocre or they're okay, but the ones that are kind of new have to be brilliant, and that's just not fair to put that pressure on them. So I think there's definitely room for mediocre stories as well.
Yes, no, I hear that. The Regulars, I presume, is obviously with the success of that, there's a lot of knocks on your door and your manner of speaking. Are there big projects afoot?
Well, I'm currently down in Dublin doing a job that I'm very excited about, because I feel like this city has been calling me for a long time, and it's so exciting to be here.
What does that mean, Thalia? The city's been calling you for a long time. I like that expression.
I don't actually know. Like, I feel like I was meant to be here. Lots of things are kind of telling me, mostly in my own heart, I think. Maybe that's me projecting the wishful thinking and being like, yeah, that's it. Or maybe I made it happen, I'm not sure. But I just think there's a real creativity here, and I felt like that's where I want to be. I want to go and experience that city, and even with lockdown, I can feel the culture here, and it's very exciting. So hopefully I'll get to experience a bit of it if it opens up soon.
Is that a big top secret project, by the way?
I don't know. It might not be, but I'm scared to say anything in case I get shouted at.
Is it a movie or a TV show?
It's a TV show.
And is it one that's established or a new one?
It's a new one.
You see, I'm really good at charades. Be careful. No, I'm not really.
Hello.
Okay, you're 24 years old and you are Thalia Graham. Am I saying your name correctly, by the way, Thalia?
Yes, you are indeed. Thalia Graham.
And you are one of the most refreshing people I've spoken to for a long time. So I've loved your company this morning. No, I really mean that. And I'd love to see you on the Late Late Show very soon.
I'd love to come down and see you.
Yeah, great. Well, let's do that. So keep going. What your parents should be, at the risk of sounding like the oldest man in the world, but your parents have so much to be proud of in what you do and how you conduct yourself and what you say. So well done. Enjoy Dublin and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
And you. Thanks so much. That's Thalia Graham there. She's the star of The Irregulars, which is, as I say, it's sort of a spin-off, if you like, of the home story. But what an intriguing, intelligent, tuned-in young woman and somebody who would give you great hope, would she not, for the future.